The mandala of the five Buddhas. And on this occasion, we're entering the mandala from the south, and we're meeting the Buddha of the south, Ratnasambhava. And this is a depiction of Ratnasambhava by an artist called Aloka, who's part of the same order, myself and Pranyanita in the West, the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. He's a full-time artist, and he produces these amazing images. So you can see it's the yellow Buddha. So associated with the wisdom of equality. So this morning Pranyanita mentioned that the wisdom associated with Akshobhya was that the mirror-like wisdom. But the wisdom of Ratnasambhava is called the wisdom of equality or wisdom of sameness. And just as the mirror-like wisdom was a transformation of contact, so that first process of knowing, you know, coming into contact, the bare knowing, sense knowing, that constant of the mind, that ever-present process in the mind. So just as that was transformed into the wisdom, the mirror-like wisdom, well, the second basic fundamental process of our minds, which is called feeling tone. And if you like, feeling tone is that immediate response to contact. So we have an experience, and what happens, what follows on immediately, it's kind of an assessment, an evaluation of the experience. Is it potentially dangerous, or is it safe? Is it potentially going to hurt me, or is it benign? You know, we evaluate it in terms of our well-being. It's a very primitive, basic, primal instinct. Is it pleasant, or is it unpleasant, or is it just neutral? So, and that happens just, you know, in a flash. This is a very important evolution, if you like, development in our evolution, because it means we can adapt much more quickly to our environment in terms of our personal welfare. So in terms of survival, in terms of thriving as a being in a potentially competitive environment, this is very important, and not to be devalued, you know. But the thing is that this is always the case, that Buddhism calls us, if you like, to a higher evolution. There's more to us, however important the primal is. In a sense, everything else is founded on that. And however important that is, there is more to us than the primal. Our potential goes way beyond just surviving and thriving. So feeling tone, that's very important evolutionary adaptation, if you like, that evaluation of our experience as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's just that it's very limited in scope. It's very much related to personal welfare. It's all about me and mine. So the awakened mind transforms this very narrow scope. It kind of explodes it into an unlimited expansion on awakening, on enlightenment, beyond the confines of just me and mine, just beyond the confines of kind of limited self-view and self-concern, and transforms it into this wisdom. So feeling tone becomes transformed into the wisdom of equality, or the wisdom of sameness. And you know, this wisdom really flows from the wisdom, the mirror-like wisdom, that mirror-like wisdom that Pranyanita described as allowing us to see the world the way it really is. And one aspect of the way things really are, or maybe I'd say before moving on to that, is if you like, I'll present you this image. It's the image of the jewel, because Ratnasambhava His name, Ratna, is Jewel, Sambhava born. So his name is the Jewel born. And if you like, you can use the jewel as a metaphor or an image for the enlightened mind. So imagine a jewel, now just a jewel that has many facets. So I see the jewel in this image of Ratnasambhava that doesn't particularly have facets. But if you can imagine a jewel with many facets, it's like each one of these wisdoms is a different facet of the enlightened mind. And that they're all part of the same wisdom. They all create a whole and they complement each other. And in the same way that the different wisdoms kind of complement each other. So the wisdom of the mirror-like wisdom associated with akshobhya, that seeing things as they are, it gives rise, if you like, in some sense, to the wisdom of equality, or that they're just so complementary, they complement each other, because this is the way things are. It's a realization that at the most fundamental level, all beings have the same nature, share the same nature. So this, you might be scratching your head and think, well, that doesn't quite square with my daily experience. What do you mean all things have the same nature? The thing is, obviously at one level, everything has a different appearance, different aspect, different form. We're not denying difference. Buddhism doesn't deny difference. It's just saying there are different levels at which you can look at form and phenomena. Of course, difference is important. You know, becoming individuals is essential, an essential part of our growth. You know, separating from our parents, in a sense, is an essential part of maturation. And being an individual is partly separating from the group, and group mentality and group thinking, forming our own ways of thinking, our own style, our independent decision-making, becoming responsible adults. So becoming different, becoming separate, is adds to the richness and diversity of society. Buddhism is not downplaying that. That's all very much recognized. And in fact, we look at it a bit more deeply through Amitabha. But for the moment, we're focusing that at a deeper level, we all share the same nature, that there is this unity in diversity. And you know, you can look at it simply from the point of view of our common humanity, for example. We're all equally worthy. We're all equally precious. And this, of course, speaks to our time, doesn't it? In these days when, very rightly, you know, the issues of gender equality and racial equality and sexual orientation equality, Black Lives Matter, you know, these are part of the zeitgeist and about time too. So this sense of a shared common humanity is the basis for this. And it stands as a basis for solidarity. Solidarity with people, even when we don't agree with what the opinions they hold, the way they are. You know, they might disagree, they might be kind of a bit cranky or crotchety. We still share with them a common humanity. Let me read you a piece. It's actually a poem from Miller Williams, which goes, "Have compassion for everyone you meet, even if they don't want it. What seems conceit, bad manners, or cynicism is always a sign of things no ears have heard, no eyes have seen. You do not know what wars are going on down there, where the spirit meets the bone." So down there, you know, where the spirit meets the bone, that's my favorite phrase from that poem. We don't know what's going on, but we do know from our own experience, where our spirit meets our bone, we have an experience of our own weakness and frailty and humanity. And if we really experience that and acknowledge that, we can understand the frailty, the humanity of our fellow human beings. So that's at one level of this wisdom of equality. There's a more fundamental level again. It's a sense that our nature is no nature. This is described in Buddhist terms as shunyata, variously translated. So shunyata is the Sanskrit word, and it's difficult to translate. It can be translated as emptiness on the one hand, and just to confuse things, it can be translated as fullness on the other. Okay, so let's try and get a grasp on this term of that is shunyata, that is the basis of the sameness of all phenomena. So it's emptiness. Shunyata is emptiness in the sense that it's empty of a fixed essence, devoid of fixity. There's no stable essence in any object. This is the Buddha's teaching. There's no thing has an inherent existence in the sense that there is no thing. Every thing is insubstantial. Nothing lasts long enough to be called a self. Everything, if you like, can be described as just empty phenomena rolling on. It's the nature of reality. Ephemerality is the nature of reality, just flowing. So there are no things, there are just these phenomena, a confluence of phenomena in the world of which we are just part of the flow. It's like we're eddies, all eddies within this river of phenomena. One way of explaining this a little bit further, because it's not necessarily easy to get one's head around, is it? Is that it's based on the fact that our existence is contingent. It's dependent upon very specific conditions. If you get rid of those conditions, then we stop existing. So we're totally dependent on these conditions. And on a basic physical level, we're dependent on the air we breathe, maybe the food we eat, the medicine we have. As social beings, we're dependent on our parents, education, social mores, culture, religion perhaps around us, friends, relationships, jobs, all of these factors, all of these phenomena in our lives affect us and make us what we are. They change, we change. And of course, coronavirus has underlined the changeability of the conditions all around us. So many of those factors have had to shift, our contact with people. Maybe some people here have lost jobs, our money, sadly even friends or relations to COVID. Just underlining the ephemerality, the fragility of the conditions that support us. So we all and all phenomena arise out of causes and conditions. So effectively, you could say one way of looking at reality is that it's all appearances. All these phenomena are appearances, a bit like a rainbow. So a rainbow, is a rainbow a thing? It certainly arises on the basis of light shining through moisture in the atmosphere and viewing it from a certain angle. So all these conditions have to come together before you see a rainbow. So it's a very vivid experience and beautiful, often moving experience, isn't it? Particularly a really vibrant rainbow. It's vivid, but is it substantial? And you could say all the phenomena that we experience are like this, are like rainbows, just dependent on very specific conditions. Remove the conditions, the phenomenon ceases to exist. In a sense, that's all we have access to. Those appearances are all we have access to. So this wisdom of Ratnasambhava, that wisdom of equality, all beings have the same nature. This supports a sense of not just solidarity with fellow human beings, but a sense of solidarity with all of life, an identification with all of life. So if the boundaries of that separate us from other beings, are dissolve, then we in a sense there is no separation between ourselves and other beings. And we kind of, I don't know if you spend time in nature at all, if you have this sense of an affinity, a resonance within you for the life around you. It's one of the joys of being in nature, I think, is being just, or being surrounded by hearing bird song, is that sense of life resonating with life. And it lifts us out of a sort of a narrow identification. It emphasizes this, the fact that, you know, separation is a mental construct, that our self does not have to be this narrow being confined within this small skull. And what that narrow self-concern leads to, of course, is a kind of confining self-identity, attachment to what we identify with, perhaps our bodies, for example, and self-preoccupation. So a self-preoccupation that ends up in just comparing, you know, so then I'll compare myself with my friends, or I'll compare myself with my colleagues, and on so many ways, how I'm performing, how much I'm receiving in terms of remuneration, Buddhism sees these comparisons between ourselves and others as all a manifestation of pride. And so pride is the particular affliction that the Ratnasambhava works with. I think we heard with Akshobhya it was some hatred, but with Ratnasambhava it's pride. So once we stop comparing ourselves with others, once we are not self-preoccupied, so many of our anxieties and insecurities can just dissolve. And we can embrace a very radical implication of the wisdom of equality, which is living from a place of equality of self and other. Which, if you like, is another way of putting a radical empathy at the highest level. So your pain is my pain. Your success is my success. And this, of course, is, you know, the basis of rejoicing in merits, which we very much, it's a practice within our tradition, rejoicing in merits, that we go out of our way to recognize the skills, the achievements of our people in our community, you know, particularly when they've just arrived, or they're leaving, or on their birthday, or on any special occasion, is kind of an opportunity just to rejoice in somebody's good qualities. Ratnasambhava is seen as the patron of rejoicing in merits. It's kind of a generosity of spirit, and I'll be talking more about generosity, because that is the virtues associated with Ratnasambhava. So while self preoccupation leads to anxiety and insecurity, living from a place of equality of self of other and other leads to care and generosity. There's a quote from Shantideva, the I think it was 8th century monk. All those who suffer in the world do so because of their desire for their own happiness. All those happy in the world are so because of their desire for the happiness of others. So if we make the happiness of others our aim, our goal, life just turns out much happier. And we'll engage in the meditation, we'll engage in a practice that is a way of concretizing the sense of living from a place of equality of self and other. It's called Tonglen practice, and we'll do a bit of that pretty soon. Ratan Samava. You can see it's a very splendiferous image, and it's very abundant in colour and certainly lots of flowers going on. And this abundance is certainly one of the themes associated with, or qualities associated with, Ratan Samava. You can see he's holding there in his left hand a jewel. I mentioned his name is the Jewel Born. And just as the Vajra was the emblem of the, or power tool even, of Akshobhya, this jewel is the emblem of Ratnasambhava. And it's a particular jewel. Well, let me say a little bit more about the jewel in the Buddhist tradition. It's an image that comes up again and again. I've already made reference to it in terms of an image of the enlightened mind. I mean, what associations come to you if you think of a jewel? Certainly signifies wealth, riches. What is most precious to us? That's why we often use the term the jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as jewels. In fact, you know, the name of our order and movement, the Tri Ratna movement, it comes from the Sanskrit for three jewels. Tri Ratna is three jewels. The three jewels being the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. So that which is most precious, or those values that are most precious to us as Buddhists, if you like, that's what identifies a Buddhist, is going for refuge, valuing commitment to the three jewels of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. There's another meaning to jewel which I'm particularly fond of. Often it's a compound image, the jewel in the lotus, Mani Padme Hung. Mani Padme Hung is one of the mantras, Avalokiteshvara's mantra. And what it means is Mani Padme is the jewel in the lotus. And the jewel there refers to, well, it's about us, really. It's about our depths. At our depths, there is a jewel. That is really what we are in essence. It is our enlightened being, if you like, our Buddhahood, which is our essential self. It is at base what we are, just being aware, having a conscious, having a mind. This is our essence. And that, if you focus on that element, you know, it can alter your practice from being one of kind of striving to grow and develop, which is very worthy, and sometimes that's how we need to work, particularly perhaps when we start on the path. We need to focus on that path of self-development. But there is this other path of self-discovery where the emphasis is just relaxing and unfolding into what we already are. But coming back to the jewel that Ratnasambhava is holding there in his left hand, it's sometimes described as the Chintamani. So that's a very particular jewel. And it's a mythical item, just like the Vajra. It's a mythical power tool in the Eastern tradition, which is the wish-fulfilling jewel. It's a sense that it will give, it's like a genie bottle, you know, you rub the bottle and the genie pops out and gives you three wishes. That's the sort of mythical item that the Chintamani is. And the Buddhist take on that, obviously that can take you down very materialistic roads indeed, but the Buddhist take on that is that once you have the Dharma, once you have that wish to grow for the benefit of all beings, then you have everything you need. Once there's this character, this historical individual called Milarepa, and he lived up in out in the wilds of Tibet, and he lived in caves, and he ate what he could find. You know, he was really poor. There was one occasion where he was in his cave and sleeping, and he heard a thief in the darkness. He knew it was a thief, so he was sleeping there, and he could hear this rustling around his cave, and he knew there was a thief marauding around his cave. And he just piped up and said, "Look, I know you're here to steal things. You know, if you happen to find something in the dark, well, fair dues to you, because I couldn't find anything here in the light of day." You know, so he and people used to ask him, "You know, why do you live in basically a loincloth in the cold of the Himalayan mountains with very little food?" You know, people are offering him all sorts of things. They were offering him their farms, their houses. They were offering, because he was such a brilliant teacher. And he would say, "Look, I have everything that I need." As far as he was concerned, he was incredibly wealthy because he had everything he needed. Put another way, his needs were very simple. His needs were for the Dharma and for spiritual growth. And that he found within. He didn't need that out of himself. So he had what's called a wealth mentality. He didn't have a sense of lack. I mean, most of us have this sense of lack, don't we? You know, we'll be happy if we get that, if we, whatever that is for you or me. Because we're looking for satisfaction from outside of ourselves. So this Chintamani is a symbol for what's called a bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment. It's an amazing term, this bodhicitta, which I don't have time to go into here, but it's a very inspiring term. You can see the bodhicitta as kind of an impulse, a force, not just within oneself, but kind of within the universe. There's this impulse towards compassion, impulse towards becoming enlightened for the benefit of other beings. So abundance then is the hallmark of Ratnasambhava. And once you have abundance, well, generosity really follows naturally, doesn't it? Well, if you have a sense of abundance, you're happy to give. So Ratnasambhava, in a sense, is the king of giving. And the Buddha just can't emphasize enough the importance of giving and sharing. Dana, giving, is brought up again and again. So many lists of how to live one's life, generosity is comes up front again and again. He says this at one point, does the Buddha. "Oh monks, if people knew as I know the result of giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given. Even if it were their last morsel, they would not eat without having shared it if there were someone else with whom to share." Generosity, giving, is such an expression, a basic expression of our humanity and our shared, you know, that shared humanity. It brings us into relationship with other people. And of course, it flows from a sense that we can achieve through meditation of our own needs. So once we know our own needs, once we know our own humanity, our own joys, our own sorrows, then it's natural to connect with the joys and sorrows of our fellow human beings. That just leads sort of naturally to supporting others, to collaborating, cooperating with others. Maybe I'll just finish with one more point, which is really the emblem of Ratnasambhava. It doesn't appear here on this diagram, on this representation of Ratnasambhava. Just as the elephant was the animal associated with Akshobhya, the horse is the element associated with Ratnasambhava. And I don't know what associations come to you with mentioning of a horse. So if you just imagine a horse bounding about in a field, it's a real sense of freedom and energy. And so kind of on the one hand, the kind of wild energy, untrammeled. But then, of course, you've got horses that work, are tamed, are harnessed. So it's like our own energies harnessed behind our own spiritual development. So that through training, the horse becomes a being that can just achieve so much. So there's a sense of energy about the horse, isn't there? This and that's a feature of abundance, Ratnasambhava's abundance, limitless energy. The limitless energy of the awakened mind, and that comes from a mind in harmony. So this book that we've been studying in our seminars, our webinars, Mind in Harmony. Once we've been able to work with our mind so that reducing the amount of conflict going on, reducing the number of competing tendencies in our minds, once we feel like align our energies behind the path of spiritual growth and development, particularly the path of growth for the benefit of other beings, then all that energy that's caught up in kind of these conflicting energies, that can all go in one direction. Our energies are harmonized, they flow in one direction, so our energies are far more available. So in that sense, it's almost a limitless amount of energy available to the harmonized mind, the enlightened mind. Okay, that's enough for me. Or maybe just one final point. I was thinking about Mark in this connection, because he was on the nose, wasn't he, in terms of time of day for Akshobhya, and he probably is again now, because the time of day associated with Ratnasambhava is midday. I'm not sure if it is midday there, Mark, but yeah, not far off. So you're in tune with our jinas. So Ratnasambhava is associated with midday, golden sunlight, a sense that, you know, that there are no shadows in the golden sunlight when the sun is above our heads. It dissolves boundaries as the light of the midday sun, and it shines on all equally. These are additional themes that one could elaborate on with Ratnasambhava. But I will finish there. So it's time for us to break up into groups. And it's an opportunity really to just explore the themes that I've just been raising there. And you know, there are a couple of questions that could come up for you. Now, for example, you know, what is it that really gets your energies flowing? Or alternatively, where do you find your sense of abundance? These are the sorts of qualities, obviously, from the talk that are associated with Ratnasambhava. Where in your life do you find a sense of being in the presence of Ratnasambhava? With those qualities. Okay, I think Pranyanita, if you can break us into groups, and if we have about 20 minutes, that'd be great, with a 5 minute advance warning of finishing up. And then of course you'll get your 1 minute as well at the end. That's an automatic. notice of and then we'll come back into a plenary session. Great.